contributor and managing editor of The Griot, Joyanne Reed, and editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, Matt Welch. Good to see both of you.
Great to be here.
This is the story that just keeps on going. A million signatures now on this petition for the GOJ to file civil rights charges against Zimmerman. But when we heard from Eric Holder yesterday, he really was talking a lot about stand your ground. Dozens of protesters marched into the Florida governor's office yesterday, and the governor, Rick Scott, released this statement. Governor Scott called a bipartisan special task force with 19 citizens to review Florida's Stand Your Ground law. This task force listened to Floridians across the state and heard their viewpoints and expert opinions on this law. The task force recommended that the law should not be overturned, and Governor Scott agrees. Matt, whichever way you're looking at, whether you're looking at a civil rights prosecution or overturning Stand Your Ground laws, it does seem like there's an uphill battle here.
Sure. I mean, it's starting with the fact that Stand Your Ground really wasn't a big issue in this trial. It never came up in the defense. The prosecutor said Stand Your Ground didn't apply to this case. Stand Your Ground applies when you can retreat.
That phrase was in the jury instructions, and it was something that was pointed out by the one juror who's given an interview.
Yes, but it was also in the jury instructions was cases where there's a home entry. It was part of a boilerplate language instruction, not necessarily this applies specifically to this case, right? So if it doesn't really apply to the case, it becomes more of a yes and or a yes but kind of case, right? When you're talking about what should we do with Stand Your Ground laws going forward. Stand Your Ground is about the duty to retreat, right? If you have an ability to retreat and you think that you have safety, there's a reasonable expectation that you can have safety if you retreat. That's when these things sort of apply. This didn't apply. This was seen as a self-defense case, and Stand Your Ground doesn't have anything to do with it.
Except that this juror made it very clear that she at least believed that Trayvon Martin had a duty to retreat.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about Stand Your Ground law, and the people who opposed it, the very small number, I should say, of lawmakers who voted against it, it passed unanimously in the state Senate. There were a couple of people who opposed it in the state House, including Dan Gelber, who I spoke with a couple days ago, and he really made this very smart point, which is that the problem with Stand Your Ground is that it encourages uncivil or even stupid behavior. It encourages you to go ahead and start a confrontation. Listen to what that juror said. When George Zimmerman confronted Trayvon Martin, which had Stand Your Ground not been there, he would have had a duty to avoid a confrontation. But with Stand Your Ground, no duty to do that. But she believed that the person without a gun had a duty to run away and go home. When he legally had nothing was compelling Trayvon Martin to go home, he also had a right to be there.
And speaking of compelling, The Griot, I thought, had a terrific piece about, and I mentioned this in the lead, how personally Eric Holder spoke yesterday, and so I just want to play a little clip of that.
Trayvon's death last spring caused me to sit down to have a conversation with my own 15-year-old son, like my dad did with me. This was a father-son tradition I hoped would not need to be handed down. It is my responsibility not to burden him with the baggage of eras long gone, but to make him aware of the world that he must still confront.
And certainly for the NAACP convention, this whole speech, you know, was about things that they understand and they have all lived and he shares with them. Do you think the president will need to say more, Matt, will need to be more specific than he has been with this statement, given the resonance that continues to have?
It's a good and open question. I don't really know. I mean, he gave a pretty measured response in the first place. When the case first came up, of course, he said, this is what my son would look like if I had a son. I think everyone in America can kind of resonate with just the awfulness of this whole tragedy to begin with. So it'll remain to be seen. But the question is, like, how can this translate into activity? I wish that President Obama and Eric Holder would take the insight that we get profiled, not we, but people of color and from poorer communities get profiled regularly. I wish they would take that insight to law enforcement. We were here in New York. Law enforcement profiles black Americans in New York disproportionately all day long by targeting them. You can release or you can withdraw some of those laws from a law enforcement standpoint, and that would go a long way towards easing up racial profiling if we stopped doing it as a law enforcement tool.
Right, but see, the thing that's really frightening about the George Zimmerman Trayvon Martin case is that, you know, the story that Eric Holder told was about being pulled over by police, being profiled by police, and I totally agree with Matt that we need to look at this idea of stop and frisk and racial profiling. But the Zimmerman case was about about a civilian being able to profile you and then use deadly force as if they were a policeman. So if we're now going to take racial profiling, the potential for police to abuse that and transfer that power to civilians, which stand your ground laws essentially do. They essentially say you can follow, pursue, and use deadly force, and all you have to do is make sure the person is dead and there are no witnesses, and you then can walk away from that situation without yourself being arrested or prosecuted. That is terrifying, I think, to African Americans, because this notion of people seeing black people as suspect isn't something that just exists within police. It exists within almost everyone. Almost, you know, studies show that most people have this implicit bias.
I think we can almost carry this over, and obviously we're not talking about something criminal, but when you look at the way Rachel Jantel was treated,
exactly,
the star, quote unquote, star witness, and the way that she has been talked about, even in front of her, as mm-hmm. if she doesn't exist. She told Al Sharpton, though, and she was pretty proud of this, that she did not let defense lawyer Don West get to her. And I just want to play that clip from her interview with Revell.
I'm a teenager. Don, how'd a jury think of an African-American teenager? They're supposed to be cussing. I did not even curse Don. I didn't show him a lot of respect because he was acting childish. He was acting ridiculous. Questions, back and forth. But I kept my ground. I stand strong. I never curse.
And that full interview will be on Politics Nation tonight, but I know you talked to Rachel as well, Joyanne, and how do you feel? I mean, was she treated fairly? Is there something in the way that she has been treated that you think is instructive?
Well, I think that the vigorous cross-examination of her is just what a defense lawyer has to do. It was the tone of Don West's questions to her. Do you speak English? I just think the tone came across very condescending. I think the fact of vigorously questioning her, there's nothing wrong with that. That's what he was supposed to do. But I even asked her, did you feel he was being disrespectful towards you? And she said, yes, I think he was. And then on top of that, she was also beat up on Twitter online, including by African Americans, who made fun of the way she looked and the way she spoke, comparing her to Madea. Lolo Jones, the Olympic athlete, even went after her on Twitter and compared her to Madea, the Tyler Perry character. And she said, look, that person is a hater. I don't care what people say. She was very self-confident and said, I am proud of myself and who I am. So I admire her for that. She's a kid. She's 19 years old, and she stood up to 2 days of relentless questioning and really stood her ground in terms of her story, and I think that's instructive. And by the way, the profiling of Rachel Jantel, it also translated onto everyone who marched in protest of the verdict. This notion that anybody who went out to protest was going to riot. So you saw an entire community, and it wasn't just black people who marched, but you see this profiling not just with Rachel, but with African Americans broadly.
I want to switch gears and talk about the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing this afternoon, because they're going to discuss the future of the Voting Rights Act. The Supreme Court gutted it. And what's been the most important civil rights legislation of our time? After all, here's Hillary Clinton and Eric Holder talking about that at the NAACP convention yesterday. Do we have that? Those videotapes? Do we have it? Okay, let's watch.
Just a few weeks ago, a narrow majority of the Supreme Court struck at the heart of the Voting Rights Act. For more than four decades, this law has helped overcome unconstitutional barriers to voting. Again and again, it has demonstrated its essential role in protecting our fundamental freedoms. Now, some take the historic success of the Voting Rights Act as a sign that we no longer need its protections. But as Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, that's like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you are not getting wet.
Let me be clear. This was a deeply disappointing and flawed decision. It dealt a serious setback to the cause of voting rights. And like all of you, I strongly disagree with the court's action.
Among those testifying will be civil rights icon John Lewis when this hearing is held this afternoon. Is Congress going to do anything here, Matt?
Well, is the House of Representatives prepared to do anything is the question, right? That's controlled by the Republican Party right now. What Congress has to do, according to the Supreme Court, is come up with a formula that makes sense in 2013 instead of relying on historical racism from 1963 to 1964. That's within their purview. I think it's an open question of how much of that the Supreme Court would allow if it was then challenged on similar grounds. But I don't know if we have the political kind of agreement right now between both parties to come up with a new formula to figure out which states and which circumstances violate Voting Rights Act.
Yeah, but all they have to do is use the discrimination from 2012, right? You had all of these states where laws were made that were blatantly targeted at trying to reduce black and youth and Hispanic voting. You could just go through all of the states where those voter ID laws are passed and use that as a basis. I think it was absurd and the essence of privilege for that conservative majority to say, you got a black president, what more do you people want? That was the essence of that ruling to me. They were saying that despite the fact that this was a law that when it was reauthorized in 2006, almost unanimously, used current discrimination as the basis for renewing it to say, oh, come on, get over it. It's been 50 years since the Voting Rights Act. You guys don't need anything more. I think it was an awful ruling, and it was an embarrassment on the 50-year anniversary of the March on Washington for them to do that.
Joanne, Matt, always good to see both of you here. Thank you. Thank you.